Welcome to the Gentle Rebel Podcast. I'm Andy Mort, and this is a show about engaging with creative spirit, deep sensitivity, and playfulness to make more space for peace, meaning, and connection in a world that doesn't often give us chance to slow down and catch our breath. In this week's episode, I want to share a prompt that we've been playing with in the Haven over the past couple of weeks or so. The money changed everything. This is another example of a neutrally ambiguous phrase that can really open up some creative exploration and space for self-awareness. I'm going to share some of the things that came out of this for me personally, what I noticed about, I guess, my own instinctive relationship with the prompt itself. And I'm going to talk about some of the things that came up in the discussion that we had in the Haven Cotter, which is where we gather together to explore ideas, reflect on some questions, and just connect together. And then I'd love to encourage you to play with this prompt yourself. So I'm going to suggest some ways that you can do that towards the end of this episode, so you can, you know, see what you discover as you let the creative path open up. So yeah, the money changed everything. Where does your mind take you when you hear that phrase? What's the kind of instinctive direction that you take? Where did the money come from? What difference did it make? I was recently watching an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. If you've not seen that show before, it was an anthology series that I think ran from the mid-1950s to the mid-1960s. Had self-contained stories that were about 25 minutes long. Alfred Hitchcock hosts the show, kind of introduces the stories and then concludes them at the end. They're mostly written, I think he did write and direct a few of them, mostly written and directed by other people. And these stories usually have some kind of surprising twist, often have a dark underbelly to them as well. Forerunner to things like Tales of the Unexpected, Twilight Zone, and Inside Number 9, which is a big favorite of mine. And the reason that I bring this up is because the episode that caught my attention when I was watching it a few weeks ago was called Reward to Finder, which is a story really about the way that money can change everything when it appears out of the blue one day. Janitor Carl finds a wallet lying in the gutter by the side of the road when he's walking home from work, and it puts him in a good mood. His wife, Anna, notices this because, he's a pretty horrific human being, but he's kind of enjoying life as he's eating his dinner. And then eventually she's like, what's going on? And he shows her this $5,200 that is inside this wallet that has no identifying factors, that doesn't sort of indicate who the owner is. And the assumption is finders keepers. Great, I found this wallet, this money's mine. And then a police officer stops by later on that evening collecting money for the police charity or something. And Anna asks this police officer, you know, what would happen if we found, or if somebody, you know, hypothetically speaking, what would happen if someone found a wallet with some money in it? And he tells her, you know, they're legally obligated to hand it in. And if the owner doesn't claim it within 6 months, they'll basically get to keep it. And if you don't hand it in, you'll be breaking the law. You could go to prison. The next day's newspaper has an advert from the owner kind of asking for it back, asking for this wallet, offering a reward for the wallet's return. And that's really what Anna gets excited about, is this idea that, you know, there are some things that she would love to buy. You know, their material circumstances are not great. She's like, you know, living very sort of, I guess, precariously, and they could do with a bit of money. So she's excited about this idea of getting a reward. Carl obviously, I think, just wants to keep the wallet. He's angry about the idea, you know, that, oh man, this owner has put this advert in the newspaper. But he's like, okay, I don't want you going and, you know, taking this wallet back. I found it, so I should do it. So he says, I'll do it after work. I'll go and take this wallet back to the owner and see what reward we can get. And then he like has a sense of satisfaction, drinks a cup of coffee that Anna has made. And he's like, you know, the one thing about you, Anna, is you're really good at making coffee. That's the only compliment he gives her, I think, through the entire episode. When he returns from work, I should probably add here, spoiler alerts. I mean, I've already given some spoilers. It's quite old now. So I think is there a sort of like an unwritten rule that, you know, after a certain while, you just assume people either have seen something or it doesn't really matter. But yeah, when he returns from work, Anna asks, like, excitedly, so how much was the reward? How much did you get from the owner of the wallet? And Carl is in a rather bizarrely good mood, given the response that he gives, which is, well, the owner gave me nothing. Didn't actually, you know, didn't follow through on the idea of a reward. He just took the wallet and that was that. Anna's like, right, I'm going to give him a call. And Carl talks her out of it and then heads up to the attic where he hides the wallet and spends a bit of time counting the cash. He didn't obviously take the wallet back to the owner. A couple of weeks later, they have another big argument, Carl and Anna. And, you know, that seems to happen a lot. On this occasion, Carl throws a newspaper at her and it happens to fall on the lost and found page, which shows Anna that the advert asking for the wallet to be returned is still there and offering the reward is still there. She quietly follows Carl upstairs and peers through the lock on the door of the attic and sees Carl counting the money, which he just seems to do that quite a lot. I think that's all he does with the money, really. He's like a proper miser. He's just got this money, enjoys it because he gets to count it. He doesn't spend it or anything like that. I don't think. She sort of confronts him, demands her share, and threatens to report him to the police if he doesn't let her start spending some of the money. And then he's like, okay, he's got no choice. So she begins spending the money, refits the living room, buys new curtains, gets a manicure set that she's mentioned earlier in the episode, like this thing that she's had her eye on that it's only $5, I think. And Carl is really not happy about this, like maybe the fact she's drawing a lot of attention to this influx of money. And then she comes home with this expensive fur coat. And that's the final straw for Carl, really. So he demands that she takes it back to the store. They have a big fight. And yeah, like then she calls the police. And she's like, right, I'm calling the police. I'm going to tell them. And then changes her mind once she's speaking to the police. She asks for the lost and found department and then bottles it. I guess, you know, maybe she realizes she's a little bit complicit in the crime by now. So instead she goes and makes Carl a special cup of coffee, puts a little extra something into it, and then takes it to him in the attic where, you know, he's counting his money again. So obviously the sensible thing from her perspective is to poison him. And Carl has the same idea, except it's, you know, hitting her over the head with a metal statue. And then, you know, satisfied with his work, he picks up the coffee. And what I can only imagine is his final cup of coffee, but at least it's a good cup of coffee. That's what we know from earlier on. And he drinks it, you know, with that sort of sense of relief that Anna won't be spending any more of the money. He's satisfied with his work and he's like, huh, yeah, lovely cup of coffee. Then the show ends. We don't see what happens, but we know what happens. The money changed everything. So it was funny stumbling on that story at this particular time. You know, I'd already set this prompt in motion. Maybe I noticed it because actually my creative antennae were open to it. And I was thinking about, you know, these ideas, and it speaks to something we've probably all seen happen in different situations, different circumstances, where money arrives and things fall apart. You know, people become kind of different around it. People get protective, they get controlling, greedy, envious when money is introduced in a situation. It can tear relationships apart, sometimes in a big display like in that story, or insidiously over time. Resentments build, stories weave their way into the minds of the characters, you know, sort of distrust about other people, beliefs morph, values start to shift, and people no longer see people as people. They see obstacles, hindrances, opportunities, gold mines. So we talked about our natural instinct with this prompt. And I noticed for me, the money changed everything. It's a negative position that I take. When I hear the money changed everything, I jump to a kind of, it ruined everything, didn't it? It was like poison. It got into our bloodstream, changed normal life into something obscene. We couldn't see straight. I lost you in the haze. Neighbors hear banging through the walls of this doorless maze, a dark cloud hanging like a fur coat in limbo, awaiting the verdict. I noticed as I began to write some poetic phrases, I suppose, in response to the prompt, that they went down this particular road. The folk around me changed as the balance increased. Less need, more greed that turned the colour of the bleed. Greener, darker, missing intrigue. It made beauty turn ugly, rich turn flimsy. I lost sight of who I saw beneath and before these layers of complexity and control. I want to go home to why I began. Innocence and naivety. I wish I hadn't seen behind the curtain. I wish I hadn't become the curtain. I wish I wasn't part of keeping this curtain hanging. I wish I was with them. The Tin Man, Scarecrow, Lion and Dorothy on a vibrant pathway full of courage and depth. It's interesting to observe that and to ponder how I could maybe flip to see from another perspective. You know, what if the change was good? What if the money arrived as a gift that could be enjoyed? It could be benefited from. It could add great value and wealth to a project, to a situation, to a life, to a community. Wind in the sails, sails for the wind. It made the whole thing flow. No strings, just unconditional trust. Not owned. Stewarded. Gifted. Giants standing on the shoulders of history. A piggyback. Piggy bank. But yeah, this is kind of what I do with these prompts. When I start to explore different ways of approaching them. And so these are some of the things that I share in these Cotter sessions in the Haven. Hope to encourage others to kind of do the same and to explore these prompts, maybe like with visual art, photos, noticing, okay, what is it in popular culture that speaks to the ideas that maybe are tied up or wrapped around these prompts as well. And so we thought about this question, what would you choose to do if money wasn't an obstacle? And it kind of took us in two directions as we picked apart what it is actually asking. You know, it's a common coaching question. You know, what would you choose to do if money didn't matter? Like if you had enough or whatever. And essentially it boils down to what comes first, the money or the vision. You know, on the one hand, we can ask, what is something that you would love to do but can't because you don't have the resources? Maybe there's a specific project that you would really want to get off the ground, get going, somewhere you would love to go, some activity that you really want to engage in, something you want to invest in. In other words, you know exactly what you would spend the money on if you had it. And you kind of have an idea of how much is enough for that to occur. And the other way of reading this question is if you suddenly came into a load of money, like that $5,200 or the equivalent in today's money. I don't know what that would be, but you suddenly found this money. How would you spend it? Maybe you won the lottery. And despite certain similarities and crossovers, these are very different questions. And it's helpful to ponder them from these two different angles. You know, we've heard stories, haven't we, of lottery winners just getting really low, wasting their winnings. Celebrities who might suddenly make a load of money who really don't know what to do with it and end up living maybe excessively lavish lifestyles that start to feel empty and meaningless. And so the second question might presuppose money as the desire itself. If you've ever had the conversation about winning the lottery, you might have experienced this where sort of like, if you won this jackpot this weekend, you know, what would you do? And responses might begin with like, well, I'd probably buy something or replace a bunch of somethings or start a something. The vision is usually quite vague, but as we began to unpick in the Haven conversation, the other side of this, you know, starting with the vision, is a foundation of meaningful satisfaction. And maybe this comes with certain personality types. I don't know, maybe even it's a highly sensitive temperament thing where well-being might be in some sense attached to having meaning, having a tangible purpose to things. There's definitely a thread in the things that people were saying. And I realized that for me, you know, the biggest thing on my mind right now is finishing my album. Like, if money wasn't an obstacle, I would complete the recording and the production and the mixing of all the tracks on my album. You know, what would money not being an obstacle mean? I guess in literal terms, £5,000 to £10,000. That money would change everything. Other people talked about the joy that would kind of come from becoming that kind of patron to others, enabling good things to come into the world. If money wasn't an obstacle, they would support meaningful causes, specific things in ways that they can only dream of right now. And this is a beautiful thing to ponder because it speaks to the unconditional belief in the vision that other people hold for their own work, for the world that they want to see come into being. How often money comes with strings attached, you know, contractual obligations that compromise and control the creative vision. See this happen to musicians and songwriters. I've seen it happen over the years. People who, you know, they kind of land a record deal, like living the dream, only to realize that actually there's real issues here. It's not about the art. It's about the money. The art and the artist is an investment, not a gift. It's not a case of financially supporting the potential creation of something that you believe in as much as believing that the support of this thing is going to, you know, make you back the money with profit. Well, that's just the world we live in, you might say in response to that. And yeah, but what if it wasn't? What if we could find ways to gently circumvent this model? I guess, you know, it's essentially what was being said when people talked about supporting and enabling work they believe in, you know, stewarding, gifting, paying forward what we have without sort of trying to coerce or control the person who is who's being gifted that money. And I suppose, you know, it's what we see in models like Bandcamp and Patreon, where we have more, I guess it's a kind of lower level access to be able to support our favorite creators, people who are doing stuff that we really believe in, without necessarily knowing what it is exactly that they're working on, without putting that money into a specific project. You're just saying, I want to enable you to create because I really love what it is that you do and I love what you stand for and all that sort of stuff. And there's a less of a conditional transactional relationship with that a lot of the time. And this whole thing kind of reminds me of a social media post I saw a few years ago. I think I may have mentioned it. I've mentioned it somewhere. I can't remember exactly where, but someone was sharing a story about how they had tried to help a homeless person by buying them food. And I think the person was maybe asking for money, but this person sharing the story said, well, yeah, rather than giving you money, I'm going to the local shop. And they went and I think bought them some food and brought it out in a bag, gave it to them. And then this other person went back into the shop, took back the food and got a refund so that they had the money for it. And the person telling this story was absolutely incensed by this, like how ungrateful this person is, how entitled they were to take what I'd given them and to go and exchange it for money. And a lot of the people commenting below agreed. But there were a few that had this sort of, you know, I guess a philosophical take, some more interesting questions to ask around human dignity and ownership and control. You know, we attach conditions to things, often without realizing. You know, you're going and gifting this food to someone, but it's hugely conditional on them doing what you expect them to do with it. We expect people to do what we want them to. But at what point does the gift become the possession of the other person? At what point does that food become that other person's food? At what point were they in a position to choose what to do with the objects they owned? Did this person ask, you know, what they wanted to eat? No. Did they ask, you know, is there anything that you don't like? No. He took the decision that he was sort of in a position to be a better decision maker. And I guess took the approach that beggars can't be choosers. That was essentially the position they took. Nothing indicated that he knew anything about this person. He didn't know what sort of allergies they might have had, anything like that. He just made a judgment, bought food, maybe to make himself feel a bit better, and then felt entitled to control the behavior of this other person by indebting him to a certain set of actions, demands, expectations that, here's a gift, but you must use it in the way that I demand you to. And so it makes me think, you know, what is a gift? I think a gift is really difficult to define. And gifting is a really interesting area to explore. You know, we might find all sorts of strange ideas and beliefs, values locked up, lurking beneath the dust around these ideas. You know, if someone buys you a gift that you don't want, what do you do with it? Do you feel sort of obligated to it, maybe for a certain amount of time? Are you able to resell it, re-gift it? What does this other person think? Likewise, if you give something to someone as a gift, and then you see that they're like reselling it or they're giving it away, what does that make you think? Are we able to let go, to pass on, to truly give unconditionally, which I suppose is the definition of a gift, is it not? You know, to give freely without expectation or entitlement to what happens with the thing once you've sort of passed it on to this other person. Otherwise, it's a transaction. Maybe not in the traditional sense of, you know, paying money in exchange for something or some kind of swap so that I give you goods and services in exchange for something in return, whether that's, you know, something now or something in the future, or even something sort of non-physical, like I expect maybe just gratitude, maybe like an even gratitude. A true gift doesn't require gratitude because that makes the transaction that's a big one that confronts me, because you give a gift, you want to know the other person's grateful. And if they're not, and you're like, well, I shouldn't have given them, it's not a gift, is it? That's one to sit with. That's quite I feel quite confronted by that idea. And gifts can be complex. You know, this is something that we talked about in our conversation, like the kind of idea of receiving from people, like how do we, are we able to receive freely without then feeling indebted? Given the world that we live in and the market models we swim around every day, it can feel hard to receive a gift without feeling that sense of burden. Even if the gift giver has made it clear, like, I don't, like, honestly, this is yours. I don't want anything in return. It can still sort of linger. It can still sit there. And this is, I think a topic that we're going to explore more, like we talked at the end of our conversation about, you know, has anything come out of this that would be worth diving deeper into? And that was definitely something that was there, whether that's a thing for a lot of highly sensitive people. I'd love to hear from you if that's something that kind of resonates as you're listening to that. But it might sort of make us want to reject gifts or avoid them. But as we know also from the topic, when we've talked about asking for help and like struggles around asking for help and feeling like, oh, I don't want to be a burden to other people. Actually, sometimes the best gift we can give is to allow someone to give a gift, to contribute, to offer their help, to support us in some way. That can be a really powerful gift to them. And what happens in the context of a big gift? Like, you know, if by some miracle I was to stumble on a patron who was like, here's all the money you want to finish your album. How would I feel about taking that? Would I be able to take that? Would it be weird? What would be weird about it? What would need to happen for it not to feel really, cumbersome and indebting? I don't think there's a blanket universal answer to those questions. But I know there would definitely need to be some conversations to lay out those thoughts, the feelings, the fears around that situation, to be open and honest, so that, you know, you're not kind of swimming in a set of unspoken, potentially growing resentments down the line. I would want to get a sense of, you know, what are your hopes from me? In the sense of, by giving me this money, how do you hope I will receive it? Not what do you want me to do with it, but how would you love me to feel having, you know, received it? I don't know if I can describe that properly in the way that I mean, but in my mind, it's a different feeling, you know. Perhaps to flip it the other way around, imagining myself giving a gift to someone else to finish their album, I'd want them to feel free. I'd want them to enjoy it, to spend it on the things that they would love, but maybe if they're working under constraints, they would not see as sensible. It's like, no, this is yours to do. Like, use this in the way that you feel creatively, you know, compelled to do so. I'd want them to know that I don't want any of it back. So even if you don't manage to spend it all, I don't want to see any of it again. I want them to kind of know that it's about the process. It's not about the product as well, that I want them to feel that freedom in the creative journey. And even if it comes to nothing at the end, that's fine. We'll have a drink together at the end to celebrate the joy of that journey, the human creativity that's gone into. Yeah, you know, if they've got anything to share with me, if they've finished the album, I'd love to hear it. If not, that's fine. Don't worry. It all depends. But I think it's worth being open to receiving gifts, certainly, as part of the flow of human creative endeavor, seeing our things, our money, our resources as temporary, like possessions, things that we are stewarding, things that we are borrowing, looking for ways to pass them on, to contribute to the bigger picture. I guess it's at the heart of what I say at the end of the podcast. You know, it's part of that definition of who we are as artists, all of us. You know, we're artists because we have the capacity to go and make somebody's day in that sense, with a word of encouragement, an arm around the shoulder, a gift in their pocket. There's always something that we can do to turn what would have been into what could be as a result of our presence in this moment. And I think there's something about creativity that comes through freedom that really feels beautiful. I talked last week about what happened in the early days of the pandemic, and how for many people who, you know, couldn't work, once the exhaustion wore off and they'd bled Netflix dry, they felt this urge to, you know, indulge that creative spirit, to create, to play, to connect, without it being tied to making money. In many cases, for those who were subsidized through schemes like furlough here in the UK, they had a sense of freedom to play. And that brought out that creative human spirit in wonderful, interesting ways. And it was a reminder that, you know, people have an instinct to create, to work, to make progress, to explore different potentials. And that work isn't what turns idle people into purposeful creatures. You know, we've shown that we naturally want to build, to grow, to learn, to develop, to contribute, to create, to innovate, to delve, to participate, to explore, to see what's possible. And the money changes everything. Sometimes the lack of money is what enhances our creative potential. Think about the projects that have invited innovative solutions to problems that would have been fixed if you had a bigger budget, but you had to get creative, you had to find workarounds. And actually that led to something profound, something beautiful, something that maybe even gave rise to a whole new area of exploration. And if you had that money to just, okay, we'll fix that with that, it wouldn't have been anywhere near as interesting, wouldn't have been as creative, wouldn't have been as satisfying potentially. The skills that have been acquired because people have had to do things themselves rather than hiring help. So many examples of this kind of thing where, you know, money changes in the sense that it can make things easier, but it makes things more homogenized, more standardized, blander. You know, if you can afford the technology, you end up doing the same thing as everybody else sometimes. If you can afford the help, you don't get to learn how it works. You don't have the chance to develop those skills, to see what is it that I can do with this technology? What can I do with this toy? Obviously, it's not always a positive thing. This is not sort of a dualistic money good, money bad, I don't know, But I mention it because it's worth remembering the freedom of constraints and the constraints of freedom. When you have the ability to do anything, it often ends up being both very difficult to choose and to feel content with the decision that you make, but it also makes it easy to outsource and blandify the things that we do. It takes the human spirit out of the equation. And the other topic that we picked up on in our discussion that again, we want to maybe delve more deeply into in the future is the origins and the contours, the landscapes of our relationship with money and how different people from the same background, the same family can have completely opposing values around, you know, stuff around money, around material. And I wonder how much of a highly sensitive temperament plays a role with this. You know, people talked about having different values to siblings, for example, where one person sees money as a characteristic for judging human value. It's how we see, you know, where do I stand in society? It's based on, you know, this kind of wealth measurement. And everything is about how much wealth you accumulate. While another person, you know, I just need enough to pay the bills and be able to buy enough supplies for my creative hobbies. And I couldn't be happier than in that situation. And so the language of judgment around money is really interesting too. Speaks to how the prompt, the money changed everything, can be interpreted so widely. Even the same situation could be seen in completely different ways by two people. For example, to me, I'm spending money. To you, looking at what I'm buying, I'm wasting money. To you, that's a really sensible investment. To me, it's pointless hoarding. We all have ideas of what is good or bad use of money, of resources, the things worth lavishing money on. Why would you waste good money on that? Well, why are you afraid to spend your money on the things that make life pleasurable? There are so many beliefs, values, stories to be played with and uncovered in the way that we respond to that prompt. And as we finish, as I said at the start, I'd love to invite you to play with it. Start by just letting your intuition speak. You know, as you hear that prompt, as you read that prompt, the money changed everything. What immediately comes to mind? Don't judge or second guess those first thoughts. Just follow them. Where did they initially go? Record anything that comes to mind. Then peel back another layer. Where could the money have come from? What difference might it make? Who and what was impacted? Did it have a positive, a negative, or a neutral effect? You know, if at first it seems like a positive impact on whoever is impacted, whatever is impacted, what are the unseen negative consequences? And vice versa. You know, if at first this money comes in and it seems like a really negative, destructive thing, what are the unseen positive consequences? Begin to explore other possibilities, scenarios, characters. Take those first instincts and flip them. See if you can find new ways of peeling back the layers of that prompt. Where did the money come from? I found it. They paid us. We got the grant. I won it. It was a gift. I got lucky. I turned it into a business. They gave it to me. Advertising. What difference did it make? Well, I could pay them off. We lost our passion. We were able to build the project. I didn't need to pick between those two important things. Everything lost its meaning. I burned out. I bored out. I just wanted more and more. It made our relationship feel weird. I lost creative control. What else? Start throwing these ideas at the wall. See what shapes, what patterns, what colours land. A poem, a story, a drawing, a song, an animation, a sculpture, a photograph. Just pick a medium, see what happens. What do you notice as you begin exploring it? What can you sense growing inside you? What questions are coming up? What emotions? What desires? Is there anything that's maybe been hidden beneath the surface that you're thinking, oh, I didn't realize that is something that I believed? And then if you're someone who likes to journal, then you can use the following questions for further reflection. Take that question I mentioned earlier. What would you choose to do if money wasn't an obstacle? Maybe think about it from those two angles. You know, what is it that you would love to do? Something really tangible in your mind that, oh man, I would love to go to that place. I would love to start that project. I would love to give this to somebody, but I don't have the resources. What is that thing that you would love to do? And on the flip side, you know, if you suddenly stumbled upon a huge amount of money, what would you do? What would you choose to do with that? What is something that money makes more challenging? What might society look like if people didn't need to worry about making money in order to survive? How do you think people would use their time? What values and priorities would emerge? What could you imagine changing at that collective level? And what's the most important lesson that you've learned about money? So these are questions that we have kind of running in an open discussion over in the Haven. We've got space there to share any creative things that come out as well of this prompt. We've got a little gallery there. I've added some of these unfinished poems and an attempt at a painting as well from a scene from that Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode. I just love seeing how different people interpret these kinds of prompts. It's all sorts of stuff that just smushes together to make these reflection questions really kind of valuable to think about and allowing us to see from different angles. And that can often untangle things for us, expands horizons, unpicks the lock of all kinds of things that might be causing a little bit of frustration or stuckness in our lives. I'll pop a link in the show notes for The Haven, or just come over and join us at the-haven.co. Come and get involved in the conversation and see what people are up to there. All right, I've kind of said it once already in this episode, but it's always worth repeating, isn't it? That I'll be back again next time with another episode of the Gentle Rebel podcast. And until then, remember that you are an artist. The world needs your art. Now go and make somebody's day. Bye-bye.